think tanks one and two.
I'm sorry, I'm almost done.
I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm hoping we're going to have this, some text on the screen shortly. It's out of my control. Good, indeed. Now then. Yeah. Okay, so I know I've talked to some of you over the last day or so. My name is Richard Clayton, for those of you who I haven't talked to yet, and my background is in cardiac modelling. So I'm very much a modeller, and this is a new community for me. So the think tank yesterday was very interesting and productive. We talked about a number of things. Chris showed some example outputs from one kind of modelling approach for modelling the lower urinary tract function in terms of hydrodynamics. And I talked a little bit about our experience in the cardiac modelling community, where we build quite detailed and integrative models that capture function at a number of different spatial scales, so the cell level, tissue level, and up to the whole organ. In terms of the discussion that we had, I hope that people who were at the think tank yesterday will chip in if there's things that we've forgotten. But we talked quite a lot about what the purpose of modelling is. And you can define a model as a representation of a system that is often simplified in some way, and so that it can be readily manipulated. Models should also be able to predict something that we don't know already. And certainly from the point of view of a computer model, my very strong view is that they should add value to what we know. So they should tell us something. They should be able to predict something that we don't know, we can't measure already. And it's also important that for a model to be useful, it should be explanatory rather than merely descriptive. So it should give us some insight into the mechanisms that underlie the things that we're interested in. So we talked a little bit yesterday about different types of models, computational and mathematical models. We did show some mathematics, I'm afraid. There's no mathematics in this feedback session, but obviously there is a whole bunch of mathematics and physics that underpins modelling approaches. We also talked a little bit about experimental models, so animal models that might be used in vivo, ex vivo, in vitro. That really wasn't the focus of the discussion yesterday, because I gather that was talked about in this meeting last year. We also talked very briefly yesterday about physical models, which are a physical representation, and Chris showed an example of a glass model of the low urinary tract that's been used to look at encrustation of stents. So that was the kind of introductory bit. Just to expand a little bit on these ideas, as I said, our focus really moved on to mathematical and computational models of the urinary tract, and we talked a lot about their purpose and how useful they are. I've already talked about the predictive values of models. We talked a little bit about parameters, so these are properties of the system which can be measured experimentally. And which models need in order to work. This is something we might come back to just at the end of this feedback session, is that how well do we know the parameters that we need? Within the cardiac modelling community, this is quite a big deal, actually. At the moment, we're using models of human ventricular myocytes, the electrophysiology. And these models actually use parameters from a wide range of different species, obtained from experiments at different temperatures, and some of them obtained from as long ago as the early 1970s. And we really don't have a good feel of how uncertainties in these parameter values affect how the model behaves. So for modeling, developing models of the lower urinary tract, that's something we need to think about and be aware of. We talked a little bit about what areas models should model, what kind of framework we could put together if we're going to model structure and function in the lower urinary tract. We talked a bit about fluid flow. That's probably one of the areas that's been very well developed from a modelling point of view. We talked about mechanical models, the effect of pathological injury, and we talked about the potential for models to inform clinical interventions, and also the potential for models to give fundamental mechanistic insights into the physiology. Chris, I'm going to hand over to you because we did say this was going to be a double act.
Okay, and right.
If I don't stop, I'll just carry on.
All right, thank you. Okay. Well, so what Richard was saying was talking about the sort of the principles of modelling and how it could in principle be applied to problems that are faced in lower urinary tract physiology and pathology. And in point of fact, a very good example of modelling came through from the discussion we had this morning about afferents, how to research afferents. That is an extremely complicated system. So the question that was raised by the conveners there is how do we model afferents and what does that mean? And if we were to sort of define what's the end point of our measurement, how do we define that? And how do we determine what are the components which affect our output? How important are each of those individual components? And we didn't know the answer to any of those questions. What we have is a morass of data that each individually is interesting, of course, but how do we combine the whole lot into one functional understanding of the system? So we are at the stage where we have a lot of information about how individual component parts of the lower urinary tract work. And the next stage, really, I suppose, is to put all of this together and to see which of those are relevant and which are very relevant and which, heaven forbid, aren't very relevant at all. And how can we define which of those are the important aspects of it all? So although this is rather a general summary then, really what it does is to apply to any aspect of what we're trying to do is to look bigger than the reductionist approach, and how can we then combine this to our ultimate goal of understanding how systems work in the round. So that's what that we asked the question, can anyone think of any examples? As I say, Richard sort of summarised that in that third paragraph down. One of the most interesting questions to my mind that came out of the discussion were from the urogynecologists who said that they put in tapes into people, and really they didn't know what a mechanical model of the pelvic floor looked like. How would it respond to different tapes? How would they respond after a certain period of time? How would function of the lower urinary tract persist after a period of time? These are all large questions that individual measurements perhaps can't answer. But if we have, for example, information about the mechanical properties of the pelvic floor, the mechanical properties of tapes, how long lived are they, what happened to their properties after a time, we can model all of those things into perhaps a more insightful approach into how one can implant and how one should manage patients with those situations. So that was an example that struck me as perhaps one of the most interesting ones that potentially could come out of a modelling system such as this. As I say, we didn't talk very much about animal models. I think perhaps some of the people in the audience thought we might sit down and talk about different animal models, but that was a think tank last year. But to summarise what the important outcomes of that discussion was, perhaps it was just worthwhile summarising that in those two lines at the bottom. One of the important questions about an animal model that came up last year was, can an animal model reflect the human condition? Now, the human condition, of course, has a lot of subjective outcomes to it all. Bothersomeness, urgency, pain, none of these things really can be addressed in an animal model very much. And so, can an animal model really reflect the human condition? And the answer came through was no. What an animal model can do is to address a specific question that can be put. What is the effect of something if you do something to the animal? So you're not trying to reproduce the pathology, you're trying to address something extremely specific. And in the summary that came out last year, there were a whole plethora of animal models that were generated by different people, all of them directed towards looking at a particular aspect of their interest, and not really trying to find out, if you like, what's the cause of detrusor overactivity or anything such as that. That's a much bigger question that I would propose. Is something that we could look at as a modelling approach, because we know the outcome and there are lots of possibilities to the income of this, the inputs to this, what are the important aspects under different conditions. So perhaps that what ties these two workshops together. So as to the next steps, then I propose a number of questions. What sort of models then should we aim for? So these are the models that we spoke about yesterday, the more computational models. Are the only useful ones ones that can model the entire system? So Alan Wien said, well, the only useful model is making a new bladder. So we know everything about everything, and so our goal should be to try to ultimately construct the entire system. And that must be the goal, but can we go piece by piece en route there? So can we usefully model component parts and then get insight into component fractions of it, and then as we get more expert at it, combine them all together and ultimately think of our goal is understanding the entire tract as an entity, and we will then understand the proper physiology and the pathology of that system. So if we're going to do a component approach, look at it piece by piece, then we need to look at the individual components, but far more importantly, how do these different components interact? So is the urinary tract consist of a bladder attached to an outflow tract, attached to a ureter, and these all have separate properties, and can we just add them all together like a jigsaw puzzle and make the three act into an intact urinary tract? The answer probably is no. They all influence each other, they all feedback on each other, and so we have to ask the question also, we understand the individual components, and now do we understand how they work when they're put together? And that's another level of modelling that we need to build into the system. So that's the first question, how good is our knowledge about how different components interact with each other? And a very good example, again this morning, was we were talking about the bladder, and then we were speaking about the outflow tract. And did the outflow tract influence the action of the bladder in some way? Was there a reflex that would, or was there some communication between the two that it would influence the two overall? We don't know the answer to that question, and so that's something that we need to consider in a more complicated approach. And the other one, which is a plea for basic sciences, of course, is that how good is our knowledge of just how things work in the first instance? What's our basic knowledge of the systems? And again, it's really quite poor. I mean, urinary tract physiology is a poorly understood aspect of systems physiology, and so one of the tasks that we have to do is to understand the basic knowledge of how well that we understand these individual components. So that's just a plea for the value of fundamental research, and you might expect me to say that, but nonetheless here I am being able to say that in a public audience anyway. Now the final question was who defines the questions. So that can be either the modellers, so we can think of something that should be interesting to you people who are practicing clinicians, or should practicing clinicians come to us and say, look, I don't understand how this works, is this amenable to modelling, to a greater understanding? And probably it's the latter case, but if so, then one puts certain expectations on you. Firstly, if you ask a question, I don't know such and such a thing, then it should be put in a way that people can actually investigate the process. So it's no good asking a question. I don't understand why people pee at night. We were having a discussion about nocturia just now. It's a problem, but I don't know why. So I don't know why, because. So therefore one will need now a number of supplementary questions that one can address, and if you look in a compartmental approach initially, and then put all of these things together. So for the end user, the value of you defining the problem in a way which is addressable to investigation is really the valuable thing that that we can expect. And then these questions will be amenable to modelling. We can then look to see which are the important components and which are the perhaps less important components, and then we can start to add these things all into one go. Another example, just to give you some practicality rather than just non-specific generics, again came from the workshop, the think tank I was at this morning, was the action of botulinum toxin. How does botulinum toxin work was the question. There was a stunning silence, of course, because no one really understands how it works. Does it work on nerves? Does it work on urothelium? Which nerves? Does it work on muscle? Don't know the answer to any of these questions, but can we unpick them all one by one? And then can we put the system, reconstruct the system, and see if we can get some insight into where the important sites of action are. So the experimentation is important, but then the synthesis of this knowledge into a component understanding of the entire system is also there for us to do as well. So those are the sorts of questions that we've put. Now these are the people down the bottom there who have either come to me, and Richard say that they found that particularly interesting, and they would like to contribute. But if there's anybody else, of course, then all they have to do is to contact either of us, and we'll put together some summary of what we've spoken about so far, and perhaps suggest some particular projects for the future that we might actually tackle. So if there are any particular questions that people have of interest, then we would of course be more than delighted to hear from you, and then we can incorporate those as particular aspects of how we can take this approach to investigating pathological problems in the lower urinary tract. So that was our morning yesterday, I think, wasn't it? If anybody else who was there has got anything additional to add that we feel has been left out, then please say so. I'll be pleased to hear.
So it's nice to see how modest you are. You're offering yourself as a service industry to the rest of us.
I'm just your servant, yes.
So, I mean, I think just generically now, not specifically talking about this think tank, I think it's nice if we can come up with a list of priorities of research projects. But essentially, for the purposes of this, you're saying, well, you can't really do that because you need the clinicians to come to you.
Yes.
So in terms of your service industry, what are the things that you can be doing to ready yourself to be most effective in responding to our approaches?
Well, I mean, we can do this in one of two ways. I mean, as basic scientists, then we have a certain knowledge of the fundamental science of the lower urinary tract. And so we can, through our reading and our own knowledge, know what particular components might be contributory to an understanding of a particular clinical problem. So that's one that we can offer our academic knowledge. And the other, of course, is to be able to offer, Richard far better than I, would be to offer the ability to synthesize this into some output, into some model, into some real model. So the question that you would do would be to interrogate a model. You would change the parameters. That's what we really need to know, the values of parameters. So measurable, definable measurables. And we can adjust the values and see, are they important, are they not important in the total outcome. So those are the two service components we can offer. So we need you guys for the intellectual inputs to it all.
Yeah, I think what we've got a real opportunity here to set out, I mean, and maybe we can do this if we write this discussion up, to set out what we know about the physiology of the lower urinary tract and the different components and their interactions, where we believe the knowledge gaps are, and how we can build on some of the very good modelling that's been done of hydrodynamics, and add to that things like the mechanics of the bladder wall and how that plays out for mechanotransduction and so on. So I think what we would like to do is, and part of the reason for saying that is that in the cardiac sort of community, there's a fairly well accepted set of things that go into cardiac models, and I get the sense that's not the same in this community, and maybe that's something we need to do. But I don't think that should be for the modelers to do. We need to do that in interaction with clinicians and basic scientists. So
would it be useful, Franz, for you to give that illustration from cardiac so we get an idea of the sort of things you need to
Do you want me to do it now?
Yeah.
So cardiac, some of you will have seen the stuff that I showed yesterday. Some of you might have seen stuff about heart modelling before. And generally, a cardiac model will include a description of electrophysiology at the cell level, which is based on the currents that flow through ion channels, pumps and exchangers, based on calcium storage and release inside the cells. So that's kind of one block of the model. Models of cardiac cells or the cardiac cell membrane are coupled together into a model of tissue. And you can implement that model in a two-dimensional sheet geometry, which might link into an experimental preparation where you've got cultured cardiac cells. Or you can implement that model in a whole heart geometry, which you might obtain from MRI or some other imaging modality, or you can implement the model in a small region of the left ventricular free wall. So you can pick the geometry that you use. So you've got cells, you've got a tissue model, you've got your geometry, and then you've also got mechanics as well, which represents the effect of force generation at the cell level, and how that balances out with the overall mechanical properties of the organ. And then on top of that, you could build in other areas like the fluid dynamics of the blood within the chambers of the heart and how it moves through the valves. You can build in elements of the coronary structure, so you can start to look at perfusion. And you could also, as part of your cell electrophysiology model, think about metabolism and so on, which gives you a way of beginning to model ischemia. So these are the different kind of components that go together to make a cardiac model. So that's the kind of mindset that I've got, which may not be appropriate for this community, but there may be some ideas which do translate across.
Richard, over here. Marcus Drake from Bristol. The cardiac models are enormously impressive, but they are, of course, derived from decades of input, vast amounts of investment, huge numbers of scientists participating, which probably is achievable in the context of hypertension and the huge impact on the population scale of cardiac disease. Now, when we started thinking about a similar sort of approach in the urinary tract, we wondered whether it would be possible to model the entire urinary tract. And then we started reflecting on the fact that the urinary tract has a huge neural input, which is not so fundamentally apparent when it comes to cardiac modelling. Furthermore, not only is it huge, it's multi-level with brain, brainstem, spinal cord, pelvic plexus. Then we also started recognising the fact that within the heart muscle, you've got cardiac muscle and relay from the nodes, but then the number of other tissues, cellular types, is comparatively small. Whereas within the lower urinary tract, you have got the interstitial cells, the urothelium, as well as the muscle, with all the ancillary surface receptors and second messenger pathways. And then ultimately, you've got two modes of function, storage and voiding, which meant that we anticipated around about £1 billion of investment might be the sort of programme grant that we would desire. So have you got that?
Mm-hmm. Sadly, no. No, I think that's a fair point, and I think it's an inescapable fact of any biological system, actually, is that there's a lot of complexity, and I think that's where the last comment on this slide is really key, actually. It's a horrible phrase, but the low-hanging fruit argument. What's there that we could do to get started? And in a sense, that's really what happened with cardiac modelling. So Dennis Noble, doing his PhD in the early 1960s, decided that he could probably extend Hodgkin and Huxley's model of the squid giant axon to model a excitability in a cardiac cell, and that was really the start. And you have to start somewhere. I think we have learnt a lot in the cardiac modelling community, and I think one of the biggest lessons that we are still learning is that it's really important to share models and data and to have a community, and obviously the internet has made a huge difference to that. But there are lessons like that which I think we can learn. But I think it's also to some extent down to you guys to specify what are the interesting problems that are amenable to modelling. So where can we get started? And then we can start to chip away at the £1 billion of investment that we might need. And I'd also say that we probably, and this is something we did talk about yesterday, we probably don't want to build a gigantic model of everything, because right at the beginning of this summary I said that a model should be some kind of simplified representation of reality, and you simplify it because it helps you. A quote which I'm very fond of using is from George Box, who's a statistician, who says that all models are wrong because they all make simplifications, but some models are useful because they make enough simplifications for you to get an insight into the system.
I would like to Homer van Koeveringen from Maastricht. I would like to comment on the last question as well. You said you are offering a service, but I think what is very important in this last question is that you have a constant interaction between the clinicians and the one that does the modeling. And once you lose that, you cannot meet the expectations. And also what accounts for the animal, what you said about the animal model, Chris, that you have to have a very specific question. I think that is also valid for the whole modeling in a way, because you cannot model the whole system, and you just said that. And we have to have those specific questions, but for that, to develop those specific questions, you need to know what is possible and what is known already, and what is the input of the model to answer that question, and whether that input is enough. So,
I think that's what we'd like to do, actually, if we write this discussion up, is to actually set out very clearly what we do know and where the gaps are, because I think that's an important starting point.
And it has to be said that there's a question over there, that all solutions like this are iterative, so you have to go through cycles, and it improves, of course, as you iterate round successive cycles. So that's the procedure to go about it.
With regard to the last question, what questions are amenable to modelling? And you said, you know, it would be nice to go for the low-hanging fruit first. With my health services research hat on, I would like to add to that. The model you should go for first is the one that's most likely to make a difference to patient benefit. You know, so you might be able to make a perfect model of bladder function, say, but if it's not going to be translatable or not as useful for patient benefit as another model, the one you should choose first is the one that's going to make the most difference, or perhaps the one that you know least about, that's going to make a difference to patient health. So it's patient benefit should be your first criterion for which model.
I'll do it now. I'll put it in now.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful.
Right, whilst I'm doing that. Yeah. Yes.
If you permit, Alan. Last thing. I read this morning in the newspaper a very heavy attack of the Animal Liberation Front against animal models. Do you think that if they politically can succeed by the end of the year so that all animal research is forbidden, can you help us out?
That's rather a large question for us.
I think help, but I think complete replacement is probably a bit optimistic. But having said that, I think it's perhaps always dangerous to highlight using modelling to replace animal experimentation, but it's another argument which could perhaps be made in bids for funding and so on. So, yeah.
Best not to think about those sort of things.